Cultural welfare of all races, creeds, and colors. 90.7 KPFK. Power to the people. Right on.
All right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. That's right, I'm back again and again and again. All right, so we're getting to know each other. I think that's been, we're past that, okay? Anyway, we have a jammed show for you today. At the back end of the show, we're going to be talking with Hunter Walker, White House correspondent for Yahoo News, who together with Jonna Winter reported that the FBI is monitoring groups on the border that are protesting U.S. immigration policy. And that, I talked with Hunter just a few days ago, and it's a really, really interesting interview. All right. You learn a lot off of this. Before that, we'll be talking with Dar Jamail on the climate emergency. And Dar has been covering the impacts of climate change for Truth Out for several years. And he's written a book called The End of Ice. And we'll be talking with Dar about what's happening now and what's it looking like in the world right now for human beings having to live in a climate emergency. Before that, though, I'm really pleased to welcome back to the show Andy Z. Andy is a co-initiator of Refuse Fascism, and he's also involved in the Get Organized for an Actual Revolution tour. And we're talking with Andy about an upcoming event that's going to be happening here. And we're going to be talking about what's going on around the country, but also an upcoming event that's happening here. And he is going to be in town for that for a while. So I'm really looking forward to the chance to see him, and perhaps even maybe convincing to come back again next week. Anyway, see, I got that in, Andy, without even asking you. Andy, welcome to the show.
Thanks a lot, Michael. How are you doing?
Good, and you?
All right, we're getting ready.
Yeah.
We're getting ready.
Yeah, definitely, man. Well, let's start now with letting people know that you are what you're getting ready for, that you're going to be in town next this coming week, talking about as part of a town hall. When do you say enough? Tell people what this event is about just to get started.
Yeah, this is a town hall meeting that we're having at the Echo Park United Methodist Church, which is at 1226 North Alvarado in Los Angeles. This is a site where there's been many meetings of Refuse Fascism, and including that this is the site where the LAPD sent a confidential informant in to spy on Refuse Fascism 2 years ago, and has since been the source of a lot of struggle in Los Angeles and editorials and op editorials, statements by the police. But this particular town hall is titled, "When Do You Say Enough? A Town Hall, a Time to Act. Why is this fascism? Why we need to get into the streets to demand Trump and Pence must go now?" And I'm excited in that I'm going to be speaking with on the podium with Frank Wolf, who's the pastor of that church and has been very active around immigration, but also with Refuse Fascism to drive out the regime. Stephen Rohde, who's the chair of the Interfaith Communities for United for Peace and Justice, or Justice and Peace, I think is the correct name, and he's been a longtime activist and lawyer with the ACLU, and Alan Meyerson, who's a film and television director, and if you haven't heard of his name, you've seen his shows. And so all of us are going to be talking about this question of why this is fascism and what needs to be done about it. And while we're all, I think, have a basic agreement that this is fascism, we're going to get into why that is so. I hope we have a robust discussion between us, because I'm sure that within our agreement, there's going to be lots of things that we're going to tussle over in terms of how do we get rid of it, how do we, what is it going to require of the people, and why must we do this now?
Yeah, you know, it's really important that, you know, one, just the subject of this forum coming up, and but also just what you were just saying. I mean, you know, this point about the event speaking about how we must not reassure ourselves that it couldn't happen here, and actually there is quite a bit of that going on. I mean, you know, you see the fight to get people out in the streets. You know, look, it's very important that people, and very, you know, uplifting that people have gone and are going into the streets now around this, you know, what's happening with the environment and all this other stuff. But there's also a bigger question here in terms of people recognizing, look, you know, it's not a well received, or it's not a, you know, people might just sort of look at you and say whatever, you know, yeah, okay. But this idea, it's more than an idea that fascism is storming the palace, basically. I mean, fascism is actually coming up and, you know, and it's actually taking root. And people are not paying enough attention to that or seeing it or refuse to see it. And I'd like to talk with that because you guys have been actually very, very much on the front row of – on the front line of actually trying to bring this to people and bringing it out to people in the myriad ways it shows itself. But that gets even more important today.
Yeah, well, it's important that people understand what they're facing and they'll act on what they understand. And I think there's a tremendous amount of dread in society right now about this regime. But it's coupled with, you know, a situation in this country where people are confronting, it's kind of an irony and stuff, they're confronting a fascist regime. On the one hand, they don't want to accept that it's fascist. On the other hand, they're somewhat intimidated by it. At the same time, because of the fact that America sits on the top of the pile in the world and is the leading empire, the sole superpower, people have a relatively comfortable life. And that the fascism right now is directly hitting millions of people, but there's tens and hundreds of millions of people who aren't in America who aren't directly affected. And they are consumed with their own lives, and a lot of the individualism that that permeates this society is signified and epitomized by the selfie. This is something that Bob Avakian, the leader of the Revolutionary Communist Party, has pointed out. And they are pursuing the elections as a way of painless progress that is going to not only do nothing, but actually is causing is both irresponsible and immoral at this time when we're facing such an urgent danger, and in that sense is doing harm and reflects this complicity with what is actually going on, which I'd like to actually get into a little bit. Maybe we could even talk about this wonderful strike that's going on today by students around the world and the threat that we face.
Yeah, let's talk about that now, actually. I'd really like to get into that. I think especially in terms of, look, the need for people to stand up. And I have a couple other questions of what you just said, but we can get into them a little bit later. But it actually all comes into, look, there's a need for people to stand up, to understand what's going on, to figure out how they're going to, you know, what do they need to do? What's it going to take to actually stop all this, you know, the rise of fascism, the bringing of fascism into the ball game in a legitimate way, and all this stuff. Let's talk about this because it's a critical question for people to get into.
Yeah, well, you know, in answering the question of why this is fascism, it's an incredible congruence of events just in the last 24 hours and going on right now. The congruence, or the coming together of the threatened war against Iran, the ratcheting up of the conflict between Saudi Arabia and Iran, Saudi Arabia being the U.S. ally and U.S. saying they're the guarantor of they want to be the guarantor of what happens in the Middle East, and the student strike around the environment. On the student strike around the environment, this really poses a lot of very important questions. Both of these questions concentrate existential questions, meaning the survival of humanity, the threatened war against Iran, and the devastation of the environment. And I won't go into too much on the environment since you're going to have Jar on after me, and he can talk about the kinds of things he's been drawing attention to, like 10% of the world population won't have water in the imminent future. So there are these kinds of questions. But look, there's two things that come together around this: the environment and the war against Iran, both of which, as I said, are existential. But I do pose, one, the enormous immediate danger of the Trump-Pence fascist regime in their denial of scientific consensus and fact that they've reversed every single climate initiative they can get their bloody hands on, and their drive for America first, threatening war and even nuclear war, with the threats against Iran being incredibly dangerous, and they are walking a tightrope now where things can get set in motion from which there is no retreat on both sides. And this would be one can't overestimate the damage and the danger of this kind of thing. So there's the question of the Trump-Pence fascist regime has exacerbated both of these contradictions, you know, pulling out of the Iran Accord and all this. We don't have the time to get into all the details of this. But at the same time, as you mentioned, that I'm on this tour whose title is that you think you're woke, but you're sleepwalking through a nightmare. This system can't be reformed. We need to overthrow this system. And if you actually think about this, the system itself is responsible for the situation with the environment, and you cannot fix the environment within the confines of the capitalist imperialist system, because this is a system that is based on the relentless drive to profit, which depends on ever more efficient, which means ever more ruthless exploitation of people here and around the world, and the ever more ruthless exploitation of the environment and the basic resources of the world. And that you can't just fix this. And even things like the New Green Deal talk about ways to deal with climate change, but within the confines of U.S. still staying number one and in the world. And let's be clear that the U.S. military is the largest single institutional user of fossil fuels. So this is a system that does that, and the same dynamic towards profit that drives it to destroy the earth is also the same dynamic that it leads it to continually go to war. And these are two of the five stops that we give attention to in the revolution tour that are things that this system does that they can't fix and that are reasons to make a revolution. But there's actually a third, and let me just say something about that. Where we're headed in climate change is one where millions and tens of millions, maybe as many as 100 million people in the global south are going to need to flee their countries just to be able to have food and water and to survive the kind of climate change that's happening. And what is happening in the U.S. and in Europe? They're building walls, putting up concentration camps, and pointing guns, ultimately, at people. And so this is the kind of future that we're looking at here, and that's the third stop of the five stops, which is the xenophobia, the persecution, the detention, and deportation of immigrants. So look, and this is something that's true of both parties, but we do have to get to the difference between them. We say on the revolution tour, the Republican Party is fascist, but the Democratic Party is a party of war crimes and crimes against humanity. So look, that gives you a sense of what we're facing, and we don't have that much time today to get into it, but I would commend to people to look at the Constitution for a New Socialist Republic in North America, authored by Bob Avakian, that brings forward a whole different way under a different system that you could organize society and actually deal with the problems of the environment. And I say deal with them, they're difficult problems, but this Constitution talks about how you would create a society not based on profit, where there could be increasing cooperation and common endeavor with scientists and people from all walks of life and in every part of the world to join together and struggle together to overcome the barriers that are leading to the destruction of the environment and what would be necessary, the kind of economy you would need to have as one of its foundational principles, the sustainable Earth. But in the immediate situation, to even get to that world, we have to drive this regime out of power. And whether you believe in that the system, as I do, must be overthrown ultimately to get to a just world, or if you believe that the America has the potential within its current foundation and governing structures to be a force for good, for any sense of justice here around the world, there has to be a mass movement of millions of people to drive this regime out. And that's what we're going to be talking about at the town hall. And prior to that, Michael, we're going to be, or over the next 2 weeks, which is why I'm staying in Los Angeles, we are in Refuse Fascism calling for in late October to start protests like in Hong Kong, like in Puerto Rico, the kinds of things that were done in South Korea. But take Hong Kong, where not a continuation of what people have been doing here, just fighting around the different aspects of things, as righteous as that is, the different aspects of attacks, immigrants, climate, mass incarceration, but actually getting into the streets week after week, eventually becoming day after day, millions of people in cities across the country. This is what we're proposing. We want all kinds of people to find out about this. You can go to Refuse Fascism, that's refusefascism.org, to find out more details about the kickoff meeting in Washington this Sunday, the meeting in Los Angeles next Saturday, and But for a first step in Los Angeles, come out to this town hall on Tuesday night, September 24th at 6:30 at the Echo Park United Methodist Church.
Mm-hmm. Now, I have a couple more questions for you. And one is, you know, as you were talking, I kept thinking about, okay, you're beginning to talk about something that I really wanted to ask you about, but it's also, there's a morality involved here, but there's also a real, you know, basically materialist assessment of things where for people to not act today, for people to act like it's just a matter of getting the right, you know, getting the, you know, Green New Deal or getting this, you know, getting a you know, sympathetic person into office, all this kind of stuff. That's actually not just not going to do anything, but it's actually doing bad things in terms of that. And I think this point about to not act in the way that's needed is actually does add up to, and people have to face this, to not act in the face of all this does add up to complicity. And we need to, you know, there does need to be a uniting of all people who can be united to stop this fascist wave. And to do that, there has to be some understanding of this doesn't mean, you know, jumping into the Democratic Party's, you know, fest.
Yeah, I mean, look, it is complicity. It's not that people don't know what's going on. There are concentration camps on the border. Millions of people know that children were separated from their parents and kept in cages. People were going to rely on the courts to change this and to fix this. The courts ruled against the Trump administration, against this fascist regime. But they continued to do it. And in fact, they control the courts at this point. This is where you see that an essential part of fascism is dispensing with the normal political and civil norms that exist in a society and going to a more open and blatant form of rule. That relies on the single executive and the repressive arms of the state and organized and disorganized thugs who are fascists. And so this is where you're seeing this uptick in, which is quite brutal, of mass murders being conducted behind essentially the Trump agenda. There's a recent piece by Bob Avakian that Refused Fascism is used and the Revolution Tour is using, where he said, if you will not take to the streets now to demand the Trump-Pence regime must go, even after all of these outrages, what will you do if Trump is reelected? And what will you do if Trump loses the election but then refuses to recognize the results and insists he is still president? And so you see, waiting till 2020, then you're making a calculation that you're willing to have these tens of thousands of people in camps and all the things, risking war around the world, all these kinds of things. They should just go on. But then what are you going to do in this situation if he wins? What are you going to do if he refuses to leave? And frankly, without a mass movement of millions and millions of people ultimately, but it's certainly starting with thousands and thousands, creating a kind of political situation that can't be ignored. Even if you get someone in, all these fascist forces are still going to be there, and they're still going to be doing what they do. And you're going to have people say Trump is dividing society. Trump is not dividing society. Society is divided because of the underlying problems the system faces. And there's a powerful section of the rulers of this country, and there's a powerful social base numbering over 30 million people with their own TV misinformation network, Fox News, that I shouldn't say misinformation, it's a fascist network, that are organized. If we could get in the streets with this kind of movement, again, people who believe in the system and people who don't, but all of whom are opposed to this fascism, we would create a different dynamic of society, including that if we compelled the removal of Trump, you want to have forces in the street that are going to compel the removal of Pence and actually are going to question the whole setup, because you do have the courts already packed. You do have Congress, the Senate dominated by the Republicans. You do have most of the state legislatures dominated by the fascists. You do have this fascist structure running all through the police and military forces in this country. You have to actually, if the people's will is going to be expressed, it's going to have to be expressed by the people themselves. We need the power of the people to be arrayed against the power of this empire. And if you did that, then some of these people in the Democratic Party leadership and others in Congress who will not act without this force in the streets that's actually demanding this in an unrelenting way, the way they are in Hong Kong, they are not going to act. But if we are in the streets, then there could be the compulsion to save their own system and their own interests to remove Trump and Pence and the entire regime and gain initiative for every struggle for justice, including, from my point of view and for the tour that I'm working on, for the possibility of building and organizing forces for the time when we could actually overthrow the whole system.
Mm-hmm. All right, Andy, we've just run out of time, so I want to thank you very much for joining us, and I will let people know again that the town hall, we'll just do it with the town hall, Time to Act, is Tuesday, September 24th at 6:30 p.m. at the Echo Park United Methodist Church, 1226 North Alvarado, in Los Angeles, and it's 90026, in case you get lost, all right? And the speakers include Andy Z, Reverend Frank Wolf, Stephen Rohde, and Alan Meyerson. So, Andy, thank you very much, and we'll talk to you again soon, man.
Thank you, Michael. Come to the program. I'd like to see you.
I will definitely be there. All right.
Okay,
take care now.
Bye.
All right, we're going to take a quick musical break and be right back with Dar Jamail. Really looking forward to this one as well. Right, Earthquake in the Heart of Rome. All right, someday I'll play that entire song and then everybody will be playing it. All right, I'm really pleased to welcome back to the show. And, you know, I'm always trying to figure out a way, how do I get him to be on the show on a regular basis, okay? And it's Dar Jamail, and we're going to be talking with Dar about his climate emergency and how he's been covering the impacts of climate change for Truth Out for several years. And he's the author of the book End of Ice. His most recent articles detail the impacts of climate disruption, including sea level rise on billions of people. His articles and more can be found in Climate Disruption Dispatches. Dar, welcome to the show.
Good to be with you, Michael. Thanks for having me again.
Yeah, man. Well, as I was saying, it's the way things are shaping up in the world today. It's a question of people really got to step up to the front, you know, and that's something I think you really always challenge people in terms of you put in front of them what the real situation is, and then they have to figure out what they're going to do in relation to that. And I'd say this: you begin your recent article with two examples of how far things have gone in relation to the destruction of the planet. You know, Greenland and the Amazon rainforest. Give people a sense of how dire the situation is right now.
Well, it is important, I think, for the context of whenever we have the conversation about the climate crisis, that people start with understanding that, you know, there's been so many of these future worst case predictions and all of this, and, you know, and all of these stand, but we have to understand that we are already into a system where there's, by so many scientists, observations that probably at a minimum of 3°C warming that's already baked into the system no matter what happens. And that means that feedback loops like Greenland and the Amazon are playing out in real time. These are things that had long since been predicted to be off in the future, where the Amazon passes certain tipping points and through deforestation and wildfires and other impacts, that essentially the brunt of the largest rainforest on the planet turns into a savanna. We're looking at that happen right now. These wildfires that are happening, for example, Dr. Thomas Lovejoy, who studied the Amazon since 1965, really one of the preeminent experts on biodiversity on the planet, actually wrote an article about a year ago and said, look, we've already lost about 5% of the Amazon, and if we lose another 5%, I'm afraid that we'll have crossed a tipping point where the brunt of it turns into savanna. And we have just lost another 5% with these wildfires. And then when we look at the crisis in Greenland, where, you know, one of the leading experts studying Greenland up there, Dr. Jason Eric Box, and he has actually said, you know, we're essentially losing Greenland now, that there's the amount of melting, the rapidity of it that's happening so far ahead of what he and other scientists had even thought about, worried about, warned about a few years ago, as something further off into the future. Now it's happening right now in front of our eyes. And so we're basically looking at these runaway feedback loops that are kicking into overdrive as we speak.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's something I forgot to do before we came on, and I need to tell people right now. You're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, and you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Dar Jamil, and we're talking about what the hell is going on with the environment in the world, what's happening now. You know, now, Dar, one of the things I wanted to, you know, it's really... You know, I went through so much of what you've written, and I was just blown away by it. And there's things that, you know, when you're talking about things like, you know, and it's and in some people, I don't know how people could possibly look at this and think, okay, this isn't real, because you're talking about things like, okay, Greenland facing a melting death. You're talking about record wildfires in the Amazon rainforest, you know, and how the UN's chief of biodiversity even warned that the burning of the Amazon could lead to cascading collapses of natural systems across the planet. This is a very heavy situation, and it's a matter of life and death for the entire planet, not just the people that are in it, but the entire planet.
Well, it really is. And I mean, I'm glad that you put that the way that you did, because that is precisely what's happening. The systems of the planet, which of course we always have and do and always would depend on for our lives, unraveling in front of our faces. And while that's happening, instead of governments reacting to the emergency as they should, and this is not, more of the context is, this is not under the guise that we're going to stop it or change it. And I think at this point, even slowing it down a little bit would basically be the best case scenario. And that basically means surrendering to the fact that we're not going to stop it. We are living on an irrevocably changed planet, and the odds of human species going extinct are quite high at this point. In fact, it's pretty hard to see it not going that direction with what's baked into the system. And it would take us a long time to unpack that and describe why I and I think a lot of scientists feel pretty confident in saying that. But we have to understand the gravity of the crisis, and that if governments in a best case scenario, say, responded to these climate strikes that are happening as we speak around the world, which are beautiful, powerful gestures of knowledge, as far as them actually forcing governments in a globe who's basically most of the economy is tied to the fossil fuel industry and will not run without it, and think that those governments are actually going to take the radical changes necessary to even begin to mitigate this is just not living in reality. And I think that's another part of these hard realities that we have to accept. And then it comes down to, how do we choose to comport ourselves during this time? You know, if we're in a crisis, we're in an emergency situation, there doesn't appear to be anything that's going to happen to change it. Are we still willing to go do the right thing and fight like our lives depend on it, and really let go of the results of those actions completely?
Mm-hmm. Now, tell me this. You know, I want to run through a couple of things that you point out to people. The ocean's heating up across the Pacific. People can say, okay, well, the ocean's heating up, you know, so what? It gets warm, it gets whatever. But there's a process there that's actually, you know, part of pushing things in the direction that we don't want to see the world go into, but it is going into. So let's talk about the ocean's heating up across the Pacific. And then contrasted with that, and you spoke to this earlier, Alaska's sea ice is completely melted for the first time in recorded history. That seems to be one of those, like, wow, wait a minute, what moments, you know?
Well, exactly, and I'm glad you bring up the warm water in the global oceans, because that is a core component of understanding how much heat is already baked into the system and how much warming in the future is baked into the system, even if we stopped all CO2 on emissions on a dime today. The last 5 years in a row, each year has been a record warm year for oceanic warming. They've absorbed 93% of all the heat that we've added into the atmosphere, half of that since just 1997. If they hadn't absorbed all that heat, our current atmospheric temperatures would be a little over 90 degrees hotter than they are right now as we speak. So we're talking about an enormous amount of energy. And so all of that is in the oceans, and that's why we're seeing these ice sheets in the western Antarctic melting from below. Anywhere where there's sea ice and anywhere where there's glaciers terminating into oceans, all of that is essentially melting away before our eyes. because not just from warmer atmospheric temperatures, but particularly from the warming happening below. And that's why a big study that came out from the Antarctica about the Thwaites Glacier, a huge glacier there, actually found that it had been melting so extensively from below that there was a 1,000-foot-high empty cavity underneath the surface of the glacier. Literally, there's just nothing left. It's melting so fast from below, and it's about to collapse. So that's what's happening, and that you can't take that heat out of the oceans. You know, you hear people talking about geoengineering and some of these other kind of scientific, fantastical, imaginary solutions, and you know, no matter what you're going to talk about for solutions, you cannot remove that heat from the oceans. And so that's another, I think, hard reality that people need to understand when we look at the kind of world that we're living in now. And as far as the sea ice, this is an extremely alarming crisis, as you pointed out, because the shallow seas of the Arctic, right underneath those is submerged permafrost, which contains methane hydrates, which is a far more potent greenhouse gas than a CO2 on a 10-year time scale. It's actually nearly 100 times more potent. And the shallow Arctic seabed is loaded with it, enough so that once it starts releasing en masse, and scientists I've spoken with feel like that process has already begun. We haven't seen a cataclysmic immediate release all at once, as some scientists like Natalia Shikova has warned about in her papers. But that threat looms. Nevertheless, we are seeing an increase of methane in the atmosphere. There is a lot of science now trying to figure it out. Yes, a lot of it is due to the explosion of fracking around the planet. But now eyes are turning more towards the Arctic. And I've written about this extensively. NASA has reported on this and done studies on it. And I think now the general public's about to understand why so many of us have been giving these warnings for so long.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things, too, that actually sort of struck me in when I'm looking at it, and it's one thing to have read about the oceans and about what's happening around the world. And then you had a thing in this article where you talked about the Great Lakes and flooding events and how that has really, you know, become a major factor in the country today. Let's talk about that.
Well, that's right. And look at Houston today. I mean, this small little tropical depression blew up right off the coast of Galveston and then moved very slowly inland. And this was the kind of thing that in the wake of Hurricane Harvey there a couple of years ago that people warned about, that these giant, slow-moving, moisture-laden systems were going to become more the norm. And it's the same up in the Great Lakes, and it's the same in other places around the world where the atmosphere is so much warmer, can hold so much more moisture. There's less differentiation in temperature differences in certain areas, and that's why systems are now oftentimes moving so much more slowly. So they're just drenching these areas with record-setting amounts of rain in extremely short periods of time. And this is the norm, and this is why flooding, and then oftentimes followed by extreme amounts of drought, and then followed by extreme amounts of flooding, like this is really the new normal now with a climate-disrupted planet.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Dar Jamil. And we're talking about what the hell is happening with the world. And actually, there's a big question posed for a lot of people of what you're going to do in the face of this. Now, Dar, one of the things I wanted to ask you about, too, is that sort of in the middle of all this, there's a question that comes up, which is really very important. And that, you know, this question about the lack of water and food insecurity, because you're starting to look at bigger figures than just sort of the things of what's happening around the, you know, the ice, what's happening in other places. But you're looking at these big figures of people, actual human beings, and hundreds of thousands of them that are suffering terribly and will be suffering even more in greater numbers as this progresses.
That's right. I mean, if we just simply look at the fact, you know, considering what we've just talked about cursorily regarding how much heat's in the oceans, how much warming is baked into the system, and the amount of ice being lost in Antarctica and Greenland, and the amount of sea level rise. I mean, there's several studies based on paleoclimate data that show last time there was this much CO2 in the atmosphere, sea levels range anywhere from 18 meters to 40 meters higher than they are right now. One of the sea level rise experts I interviewed for my book said the same thing, basically that last time there was this much CO2 in the atmosphere, sea levels were 130 feet higher than they are right now. So If that's what's baked into the system, that means literally every coastal city on the planet, and many of these are the biggest cities on the planet, like New York, Tokyo, Los Angeles, et cetera, are gone. So the question is, where do all those people go? And then what happens when those people go? So we can really just use your imagination a little bit and understand that the question is not if, it's when. And so what are you going to do? For example, you know, we just saw the Bahamas wiped out by a huge hurricane. Why are they even going to rebuild there? And if you're really looking soberly at the climate crisis, and honest, being honest with yourself about what this means for the future, every time there's an extreme event like that in a vulnerable area, whether it's there or Paradise, California, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, it does not make sense to rebuild.
Mm-hmm. All right, Dar, we have time for one more question here, and I got so many left. Let's talk about denial and reality, because the Trump administration is actively censoring climate science. And I want to talk about that because it's really something that people have to face up to, that there's actually a need to fight against what's being done by this fascist regime and what's being done in terms of and what can be done or what needs to be done in terms of people standing up against that.
Well, it comes down to what we touched on earlier, that I think it's what is more valiant and honorable and moral than standing up and fighting back and resisting and doing the right thing, even though we understand that, look, we're not going to stop these catastrophes from happening. We're, you know, odds are best case scenario, maybe we would slow it down a little bit, and yet standing up and doing the right thing anyway. And to me, it's, you know, it's either that or sit around and wallow in depression and self-pity. And in reality, I think it's a very, very important time for us to have our turn at standing up and really fighting and doing the right thing, whether that means for political change or for protecting a piece of the earth that has yet to be desecrated by this industrial growth society.
Mm-hmm. All right, Dar, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Michael. Always good to be with you.
Yeah, and we'll stay in touch because I'm sure there's a lot more to talk about in the future. All right. Okay, thanks a lot, Dar. All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Dar Jamil, and we've been talking about what the hell is going on with the climate, and what are we facing, and what can be done, all right? We're going to take a quick station break and be right back.
The Worldwide Climate Strike takes place on Friday, September 20th at 12 noon at Pershing Square in downtown Los Angeles. More information at kpfk.org. Innovating dialogue, informative public affairs, news and information, innovative music, non-commercial, listener-supported, culturally diverse radio. We are KPFK, 90.7 FM Los Angeles.
Bottom line, I'm gonna make it home.
All right. We have right now we're going to move into our next segment, which I think people are going to find extremely interesting. So check this out.
Monitoring them. In one case, this guy whose single tweet talking about shutting down ICE was referenced. He was like, yeah, I got a Fed visit. They knocked on my door. This one border group that told me.
I recently read an article on Yahoo News that really sort of smacked me around. It was titled, The FBI Tracking Border Protest Groups as Extremist Organizations. And it was written by Hunter Walker and Jana Winner. And Hunter Walker is a journalist who's here to talk with us today about just what the hell is going on here. Hunter, welcome to the show.
Hey, Michael. Thanks for having me.
Sure. Well, let's jump into this because I got so many questions, man. You know, it's interesting because you're looking at this and I don't think people realize how much is actually going on today, as what we're looking at overall is sort of the bringing in of a much more fascistic society in a certain way, where there's all these kinds of operations of police operations that are actually just sort of piling up and it becomes accepted if nobody says anything about it. And you and your partner actually had this found or ran into something about the FBI using basically tracking border protest groups as extremist organizations. Tell me what you found there. What led you to this and what you found?
Right. Well, first off, I'll start with, you know, just what we found in this instance. And, you know, it was a document called an external intelligence note. In this case, it was generated by the FBI's Phoenix office. And, you know, the Bureau and the note itself was very careful to say, you know, this is just the opinion of the Phoenix office. But, you know, these notes are distributed very, very widely. And it also described both the office's opinions, but also intelligence that had been gathered by other agencies, namely the Department of Homeland Security. And it made clear that they are, through human sources, which, you know, can either be informants or undercover people, it's not necessarily clear, and also through social media monitoring and other measures, including just online tracking, you know, really looking at border protest groups. They are framing this as an extremist threat. And in this note, they were saying that, you know, there's rising risk that these groups could try to obtain firearms and use lethal force. What was problematic about it was every incident they cited in this note was nonviolent protest. You know, in one case, they cited a single tweet from an activist where he talked about shutting down ICE that seemed very clear to be typical left-wing rhetoric and was not really a violent threat. In another instance, they cited this digital magazine that kind of wrapped up protest actions that had occurred in Arizona from 2011 until more recently. And some of these included things like hanging banners, one event that was hosted by a local Presbyterian church. So, you know, a lot of this just didn't seem to measure up to the kind of threat they were casting it as. But one thing, you know, that I would say is, you know, I would dispute your point a little bit that this is a new phenomenon. We talked to experts who were very concerned about this, but they very much put it in sort of a larger history of government policing and monitoring of protest groups, going all the way back to COINTELPRO. And, you know, one of the guys we spoke with was pointing to this 2010 Inspector General report where the FBI had been criticized for something very similar to this, where they were trying to make the case that PETA and Greenpeace and other sort of environmental groups were a very dangerous extremist threat, and everything they were pointing to in that instance was nonviolent as well.
Yeah, I really agree with you. Given the background I came from in terms of being involved in the 60s and stuff, I'm really aware of the kind of bloody bull that the harm that the FBI and all these other agents do when they are in, you know, going after people that are, you know, especially going after progressive people who seem to be standing up against the oppression of the government. And it's sort of, it's a very heavy thing when you look at this. And when I was looking at what you were talking about, you know, even this external intelligence note, give people a little bit more of a sense of what that is and what do they claim that it actually reveals?
Right. So an external intelligence note is basically something that one intelligence agency office will make summarizing their conclusions about something that is then, as I said, distributed widely. And in this case, it was distributed widely within the FBI. And the sort of top line conclusion from it was that these groups are, quote, and this is a direct quote, increasingly arming themselves and using lethal force to further their goals. But again, and this is me talking now, almost all of the evidence cited in the report included nonviolent activity. They did point to, you know, one group called Redneck Revolt, which I am sort of aware of. It has a chapter that I've actually encountered myself in Phoenix called the John Brown Gun Club that is sort of, it's what we would traditionally understand as a militia, but it's a left-wing one. And they do carry guns. So, you know, they could be seen as a violent group, but, you know, they maintain that all of their activities are defensive. They also claimed that there was this Antifa training event, and I found what seemed to be the event that they were referring to, and they said that this event involved firearms training. You know, I can't verify that or not, but I can tell you that everything on the group's website talked about engaging in defensive activity. But, you know, the bulk of this stuff that was cited in this note reaching such a dramatic conclusion was nonviolent activity. I mean, you know, when I mentioned that report to you where it was sort of an online magazine citing over, you know, 40 instances of protests that had occurred from 2011 to 2018, God, I think it was like two or three of them were more dramatic things like skirmishes at protests or vandalism. And the rest were really, really pedestrian. I mean, literally banner hanging and marching was some of the stuff cited in there.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that you point out in your piece is you say that the FBI guidelines dictate, actually, even though all this stuff is going on that you're talking about, their guidelines dictate that investigations must be conducted within constitutional and statutory parameters, and that civil liberties and privacy have to be protected. And there's a history of that kind of rule being ignored going back decades and decades, but also even more currently, as you were pointing out earlier. And I'd like to talk about that a little bit more, if you can develop that a little.
Mm-hmm. And by the way, I just want to, I'm pulling up my own story here. The online magazine I was talking about was 20 pages long. It covered 50 events, and they cited less than 20 words from the magazine to make their point. And the words they cited included encouragement to readers to find quote-unquote relevant targets in your town. And that language of targets can sound really sinister unless you actually read the whole 20-page publication, and it makes it clear that they're talking about, you know, targets for civil disobedience. But to go back to what you were saying about sort of the constitutional and statutory requirements for FBI investigations, you know, a lot of experts that we talked to, including former FBI special agents, were saying, first off, that history of policing protests that I was referencing before is in a way a natural thing for government because, you know, it's natural for the government to take a distrustful view of its own critics. And that's why we have some of these safeguards in place. And it's really hard not to see potential for a document like the one that, you know, was leaked to us, and also like some of the stuff that was criticized in the 2010 report I mentioned earlier, as, you know, a effort to trump up and create a legal basis and rationale for policing groups that doesn't seem entirely fair. And one of the things these experts kept pointing to, it's, you know, we sort of had two companion pieces in the past month or so, and one was based on another report leaked to us from the FBI, or it might have been Homeland Security, but it showed that the government has tracked data showing that last year, almost all of the individuals involved in incidents of domestic terrorism were white supremacists. And that was really interesting because that's specific data that members of Congress have requested, how many white supremacists are involved in attempted or alleged terrorist incidents. And the government has not been willing to provide it, but we showed that they'd actually tabulated exactly that. So, you know, a lot of these activists and experts that we've talked to are concerned that it seems like the government is downplaying the white supremacist threat while overplaying the threat from protest groups.
Yeah, in fact, that's one of the things I was just going to ask you about, because you also talk about how the FBI describes the border protests as coming from anarchist extremists and dedicated to increasing armed conflict with the U.S. government. And I wanted to talk about that because, you know, one thing, there's another place where you actually show people basically being pretty mild, and you know, you've already spoken to some of that, and we'll get into it a little bit more. But it's actually, it's people who are dedicated to resistance to what's going on in the society today, resistance to what's happening to immigrants, all of these kinds of things, and actually saying no to the rise of fascism. And the result of that is the FBI describing that they are anarchist extremists dedicated to increasing armed conflict, and never say a damn thing about all of the various yahoos that are out there with their weapons and their bows and arrows and their whatevers, you know, going after people that they just figured shouldn't be allowed on the face of the earth.
Now, right, and just to be clear, this one note detailing what they see as the quote-unquote extremist threat from border protest groups just dealt with that topic. So, you know, when I say that there is other documents and other concern that the FBI is downplaying the white supremacist threat, you know, that's sort of more about the Bureau's activities writ large. This note wouldn't necessarily have included that. But what I found sort of interesting about that, I mean, I don't want to sugarcoat it, right? Mm-hmm. We live in a very, God, it's a very heated climate right now, you know, and we've seen incidents like the congressional baseball shooting. I was out right in the aftermath of that near here in Alexandria. We've seen things like these left-wing militia groups emerging that I'm talking to you about. You know, there has been violence associated with the left and protest groups, but it is not on the scale, and again, you know, we have obtained the government's own data, it is not on the scale of what we're seeing from these far-right groups and white supremacist groups. So the question is whether or not the response is proportionate. And one thing that I found really, really interesting, I mean, you know, you said right at the top of the conversation that some of the stuff that we were not aware is going on. And I certainly think that I had not been aware that the government was doing this kind of aggressive monitoring of protest groups. But when I reached out to some of the activists who were cited in the note, they were not surprised that the government was monitoring them. In one case, this guy whose single tweet talking about shutting down ICE was referenced, he was like, yeah, I got a Fed visit. They knocked on my door. This one border group that told me that all they do is humanitarian aid told me that they were not surprised because members of sort of a faction that they were associated with were on these lists that had been obtained by another reporter showing that government was monitoring these people. So, you know, I feel like there's a lot of stuff going on right now. And, you know, you're seeing in the protest space
Antifa and other liberal groups that are very actively engaging both with the government and also with these far-right and white supremacist groups. They're in conflict with each other, and they are aware that they're being tracked. But I think that, by and large, the public who is participating in women's marches and maybe donating money to help people for asylum is not realizing that that group, that type of, you know, more mainstream protest activity is being considered by the government potentially extremist and lumped into some of this more dramatic stuff.
Yeah, you know, one of the things, I just want to go back to something else you were saying, because I do think that, well, you know, yes, there's all kinds of groups out there on the left who are there and who are doing different things. But for the most part, I think actually there's a spot in your article where you're talking to one young guy who is sort of, he's kind of huffing a lot and puffing a lot and you know, you get a sense if he's actually okay. He starts saying one thing, and then all of a sudden, when you start talking to him, he's sort of backing up. And there's a question. Yes, there are people who are, I think, you know, in terms of the left, who have actually different ideas than everyone else. But I think that the, really what's being attacked right now, and especially given the way, and I think you were speaking to this, but I wanted to go over it again because it's really important. Given the way that the FBI and the system is coming down on people at the border, people trying to cross the border. I mean, I was just at a Penn event the other night, and these two people that were, one woman who was going back and forth on the border, and she would get stopped and she was held for hours, a reporter, you know, and it was all of these things that were really aimed at basically sort of dehumanizing the immigrant people, dehumanizing immigrants, dehumanizing people who are other than us that fit into the society, you know. And it's interesting because even with the part that you were talking about around the FBI, when there's this whole question of, you know, basically what are they doing and who are they going after, you know, they act like, and you present different stories about this, but they act like it's none of your business and we're doing this because it's demanded by the good of society. And this is the kind of thing that really kind of is just steps away from, you know, round up the Jews and put them on the buses.
Yeah, I mean, I think that we're a pretty mainstream news organization. The report that I was referencing before that caused some of these activists to be aware that they were being monitored, where it described, you know, a list of activists who were being tracked by the government. I believe that was a local broadcast affiliate somewhere out there in the Southwest. I think NBC, if I'm correct. So these are, you know, we're mainstream news organizations that are finding documents that are detailing this surveillance. And in the case of the document that we came across, as I said earlier, it detailed surveillance using human sources. So that would either be informants or undercover work, and also social media monitoring. So that's, you know, pretty aggressive and heavy surveillance for, in many of the instances, again, detailed in the government's own document, that were nonviolent. That's in seemingly almost apparent contrast to what's going on with white supremacist groups in the far right. And I just pulled up the earlier story that we had done on that. And, you know, there's a couple things going on with that, right? Basically, that story showed another document that detailed, quote-unquote, race-based groups who were responsible for incidents of domestic terrorism last year. And what some Democrats in Congress have raised concerns about is that the classification system law enforcement is using for domestic terrorism has actually gotten more obscure. It went from 11 categories down to, I think, 4, right? So this category of race-based is actually new. The government used to say black identity extremists. They used to say white supremacists, right? They turned it into something vaguer. And once they turned it into something vaguer, and we found this underlying data, it showed that the quote-unquote race-based category only included white supremacists. So it's a really interesting thing where we are seeing this aggressive surveillance of protest groups. And again, as I was saying to you earlier, we are also seeing what seems to be attempts to diminish the activities of the far right and white supremacists. So, you know, getting back to what we were talking about, where these types of documents and this type of data is what's used to create the legal rationale to justify this type of surveillance, right? The proportionality of the response becomes really important because it's basically, what are they doing to say who might have someone reading their emails, reading their social media, who might have someone trying to infiltrate their group? Certainly, liberal activists and experts are very concerned that it seems like the government is only aimed in one direction.
Mm-hmm. All right, Hunter Walker, our time is up, and I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Well, thanks so much for having me, Michael.
Sure, and I'll look for your stories more and more and talk to you again, man.
I'd love to do it.
All right, welcome back. You know, as I'm sitting here and listening to this, and I kept thinking, we've got to talk about what the hell is going on right now. And people have to understand that we must not reassure ourselves that it can't happen here. It is. Trump's Make America Great Again is the 21st century fascist program of manifest destiny, nothing less. America first, wrapped in the flag and Mike Pence's Bible taken literally, with a program of white supremacy, misogyny, and xenophobia. And if you will not take to the streets now to demand that the Trump-Pence regime must go, even after all these outrages, what will you do if Trump is reelected? What are you going to do if Trump loses the election but then refuses to recognize the results and insists he is still president? Think about that. Think about that. Wrestle with it with your friends. People need to, you know, really think about what they need to do this weekend and in the coming weeks. And along those lines, I just want to remind people once again that Tuesday, September 24th at 6:30 p.m. at the Echo Park United Methodist Church, 1226 North Alvarado in L.A., 90026, there's a program featuring Andy Z, who was our first guest today, the co-initiator of Refuse Fascism and part of the Get Organized for an Actual Revolution tour, Reverend Frank Wolf, pastor of Echo Park United Methodist Church, Steve Rohde, chairman of the Interfaith Communities United for Justice and Peace, and Alan Meyerson, film and television director. And on that note, I want to thank everybody that was listening today. I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, and I also want to thank my board op today, Lizette Tapia. And or Lizette, right? Which one? Yeah. Lizette? Okay. I had that in my mouth all the time. It's Lizette, and I'm going to paste it in my brain. Lizette Tapia. And thank you all for joining us. We're going to go out now with Here Is the Rose with it from Outer National.
If I'm listening, I want to hear your thoughts, see it all, like a hidden web through the walls. You want to go out tonight, you want to know what it's like when the wind's in your lungs and the fire is in those eyes. Coffins, the night is young, the hour's getting late. We're too far alone, and we just can't wait. A moment in time, then it is gone. Now, wait a second here, something is wrong.
The Worldwide Climate Strike takes place on Friday, September 20th at 12 noon at Pershing Square in downtown Los Angeles. More information at kpfk.org. At KPFK, we believe in free speech, independent thought, and universal equality. We bring you information without corporate influence or political spin. We provide a voice for the voiceless and power to the people. This is Kevin Fleming, Program Director of KPFK, encouraging you to keep community radio alive. Make your tax-deductible donation today at kpfk.org. Do it now. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Laura Flanders. I host a radio show called The Laura Flanders Show, where, as we say, the people who say it can't be done take a back seat to the people who are doing it. And that's really what KPFK is about. So thank you. Thank you for choosing Southern California's progressive, independent, non-commercial, people-powered powerhouse, 90.7 KPFK. We stream live at kpfk.org, and right now we're celebrating 60 years of service to Southern California. There are a whole lot of radio stations you could be listening to in L.A., but let's face it, there is only one that is by, with, and for the people of Southern California. Everything that happens at KPFK is about you. I'm Laura Flanders. Thank you for your 60 years of support. We are 90.7 KPFK and KPFK.org.
KPFK is supported by Richter Entertainment Group, producing Roy Orbison and Buddy Holly Rock and Roll Dream Tour at Savant Theater, Friday, September 27th. The show will feature holographic performances with Roy and Buddy's vocals and a live band. Info at KPFK.org and at wheremusicmeetsthesoul.com.
Pretty woman walking down the street. I love you, Peggy Sue.